Okay, we're kind of in the somewhere in the middle of Jesus' ministry, as he approaches where he knows his ultimately will end up in Jerusalem on a cross, but that's a little ways from now, and won't be there today, but we certainly will see as we go through here all the preparations that he is making. For himself and for those he is teaching for that day. So November 2nd reading is basically covering part of his ministry entire Sidon, which is up in the north. If you remember the map I showed last time, up in the northwest, it's actually over in Phoenicia, you know, outside of Israel proper in some cases. Sidon certainly is. And then making his way across Galilee down to the Decapolis, which is across the river, kind of southeast of the Sea of Galilee. And the themes that he's talking about, there are several. One, he's talking about the universality of the kingdom. It's not just going to be a kingdom of the children of Abraham, who have descended from Abraham biologically, but it's going to be open to more. And that's kind of indicated, I think, of him going outside of Israel and talking to people in Phoenicia and people who were not of the Jews. And there, in fact, he healed a Canaanite woman's possessed daughter. We read about that. He does several miracles that certainly are designed to indicate that God is with him, and in some cases is him. And he heals the deaf mutant in the Decapolis there area. He feeds the 4,000. There near the Sea of Galilee, that's the second feeding. You know, he did 5,000 before the second feeding of 4,000. We'll get a little more into that in a second. And then he healed a blind man near Bethsaida as well. And it was kind of like a two-phase healing there, which was interesting because in that account he took the people presented this blind man to him, asked to see him heal him. He took that man out from amongst the people. Don't know why exactly, but maybe just didn't want to put on a show for everybody. He just wanted to actually heal the guy. It would be evident to everybody that he was healed. But he first spit on his eyes, put his hands on him, and he could start to see, but only unclearly. Right? He'd see people moving around, but he described them. Well, yeah, but they kind of just look like trees moving around. And then Jesus spat on his eyes again, and also put his hands on him, and then he could see completely clearly. One of the questions I asked was for your thoughts on why this kind of two-phase healing. I think it's clear that it's not a matter of Jesus just wasn't paying attention and didn't get it all the way done the first time, or he just messed up. Obviously not. Do we know why he did it this way? We're not really told. I see Tony shaking his head. We're not told exactly why that happened. But I don't think it's in there by accident. It's probably designed to cause us to think a little bit. But we can't draw any probably real conclusions about why it took place. I've seen some commentators say that maybe it was just to kind of demonstrate the gradual kind of revelation, how in the Old Testament certainly the kingdom was there, right? It was talked about, but in a kind of a hidden way, right? And you could see it, but not clearly. And then the full revelation was coming after he was to die, and the apostles went out and finished and brought everything to light to those who would want to know to know about it. Just one idea. There are a few others out there as well. So, Jesus. One of the other question that I asked on this section was, you know, what was Jesus trying to do with the disciples when he was warning them about the leaders? Let me see. Maybe we'll just read a little bit about that. I'll go ahead and read it. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf that they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus said to them. Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They discussed this with one another and said, it's because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the five loaves for 5,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke seven loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? Seven. He said to them, do you still not understand? How is it you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread, but be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees? Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Sadducees. So what are some lessons that we could... First, what was he trying to get across to his disciples in this discussion? I think he's trying to get them to actually perceive the spiritual truths behind everything. He was trying to say to them, stop just thinking about the things that you're seeing with your eyes, about the physical stuff, and start trying to see behind that to what I'm actually seeing. You, the kingdom that's coming is not a physical kingdom, right? It's a spiritual kingdom. So you need to start thinking spiritually. Any questions or comments on that? Mr. Bill. Right. Yeah. All at once. Right. Yep. Okay. Yeah, thank you. He also criticized the Pharisees and Sadducees because once again they had asked him for a sign, and of course he'd done many signs. Many of them had seen them already, just asking him for another sign. And his response was, "The only other sign you're going to get. Not that he didn't do any other miracles, but at least to this group asking him there is the sign of Jonah." And I think we know that the sign of Jonah was. Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and three nights, and so that was the big sign they should really be looking for. That's what was going to happen here in the not too distant future with regards to Jesus himself. Okay, the reading from November 3rd, Jesus was preparing the apostles to for his ultimate departure. Previously last week we talked about that he was preparing his apostles to leave him and go out and preach on their own, two by two. But now he's preparing them even more to be there when he no longer was with them. So my question was, how did he start preparing his apostles for his departure? And I'll open it now. I've got a bunch of things I can show here, but any that struck anybody in particular that they'd like to highlight? Okay. There's one. He unequivocally confirmed that he was the Son of God. And remember, Peter, he asked Peter what he thought about who he was, and Peter answered him very correctly, which is what Jesus told him. Yep, you got it right, Peter. You're the Son of God. He explains that he's going to found the church. The coming kingdom was going to be founded on him himself. He was going to be the chief cornerstone, and that he promised his apostles that they would have the keys to the kingdom, and that they would have a big role to play in rolling that kingdom out. Transfiguration. Again, it was reinforced to them that Christ is the foundation. Christ is the one that they should be listening to. They were also presented with Elijah and Moses, and God made it very clear that I want you to listen to my son now. He's the one. They talked a little bit about timing. He said that in Mark chapter 9 there, that it's going to be within, the coming of the kingdom is going to be within the lifetime of some of those hearing, many of those hearing. At that time he was saying that. and he confirmed that Elijah must come first. I think that point was brought out, that Elijah was supposed to come first, and some are wondering, well, when's he coming? And Jesus points out that actually, you're right, Elijah must come first, but if you're willing, he's actually already come. That was John the Baptist, announced the way. The disciples kept kind of talking amongst themselves, right, about who was going to be greatest in this coming kingdom. They had a little bit of trouble getting off that idea that someone's got to be in charge, someone's got to be better than the others, and so Jesus once again kind of straightened them out on that. What does he say? He says the one who's going to be greatest in the kingdom is basically going to be the one who's least in the kingdom. I'm going to be a servant of everybody, else. He gave them the assurance that they were going to have his authority once he left, to do what he needed them to do. They were going to have each other, and his spirit was going to be with them, wherever they were together in his name. Where two of you are gathered together, so will I be there. To help give them confidence that they weren't going to be left out there on their own. And part of the preparation was just some other, giving them him giving the apostles some instruction on some key points. Peter had asked, how many times am I supposed to forgive somebody? Forgive my brother? up to seven times, and Jesus said up to seven times 70. I don't think most of us understand that to be a cap on the number of times you would forgive somebody. It was just to illustrate that it's as long as someone comes to you and asks for forgiveness in sincerity, you need to be willing to forgive them. And why is that? Yeah. Yes, he's forgiven us more times than we can count. I'm quite sure I blew through my 490 forgivenesses long ago. So hopefully it's higher than that. Absolutely. He wants us to mirror him in that regard. And he used that parable of the king's forgiveness of his debtor there in Matthew 18. Sorry, I want to make sure I'm not remembering the wrong story here. Nope, I'm not. That comes later. Yes. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, we do have an obligation to point out a sin in others after. Of course, we remove the plank from our own eye. But yeah, if someone's obviously sinning against us, we should point that out to them and then forgive them, right? And we know, and we'll cover a couple more instances, I think, where we'll see clearly Jesus doing exactly that, right? Okay, November 4th, the Feast of the Tabernacles is imminent, and Jesus' brothers are telling him that he needs to get to Jerusalem, stating it only makes sense that, if he wants to become a public figure, you need to get down to Jerusalem, where a whole different population and a bunch of people will see you. The brothers, the scripture states, his brothers don't even believe he is who he's saying he is. They don't believe he's the Christ. So they're kind of a little bit harassing him here. And so Jesus tells them that it's still too early for him to go to Jerusalem, and he's not going to go with them. However, he does go a few days later on his own and in secret. So the question I asked was what lessons does Jesus teach in the temple about the law and about judgment and about hypocrisy in John chapter 7? So some of that is covered here in this slide. You know, at the temple, Jesus explains that this teaching is coming from God who sent him, and he takes great pains over and over again to make certain people understand that he is speaking the words that the Father has given him, and he's not speaking on his own. Jesus perceives that the people are angry with him, and they want to kill him for doing what he's doing. They have a problem with what he's been saying. It's not kind of fitting with the framework that they've been used to for a long time now. So he points out that one of the things that he's accused of is healing people on the Sabbath, right? He's working on the Sabbath, and that's not according to the law, according to the Pharisees and other leaders. So he points out to them that he's healing people on the Sabbath, and he points out that you guys, if your ox falls in a ditch or something on the Sabbath, you're going to go and rescue him. things like that that they commonly do, and he kind of had them dead to rights on a lot of that stuff and the hypocrisy. And so the point he made, I think, was that the law is never to be used to justify the withholding of love and compassion. If you're seeing it that way, you need to rethink about what your understanding of the law is. He also makes a point that certain aspects of the law are more weighty than others, and that those would take priority over others if the circumstances warranted that. An example of that is he pointed out that even though they performed the work of circumcision on the Sabbath, I think the rule was on the eighth day. Thank you. A newborn male was supposed to be circumcised, right? Well, if that fell on the Sabbath, is that a problem? Doing that surgery is work for somebody, right? So that was an illustration of, yeah, we've got these two laws. But you need to do, what is the most important. And the other lesson out of that is to just, be sure, you're considering these things before pronouncing judgments on others, especially him. He's the target of a lot of that. Judge correctly. So the chief priests and the Pharisees sent the temple guards to arrest him. Who were the temple guards? They were, probably the tribe of Levi. There were several groups within the Levites that were assigned different work. The temple guard was one of that, and they kind of guarded the things that had been brought in as contributions. They guarded the gates. They made sure order was being observed within the temple side of the temple, and did a lot of things like that. So Pharisees sent the guards out to arrest him, but they came back without arresting him. Why? Because they were basically blown away by the way he talked and the things he said. They couldn't find any fault in him. He spoke not as the normal teachers and scribes, but as one having authority. So they came back without having arrested him. Nicodemus encouraged the leadership to hear Jesus explain himself before condemning him, but he gets ridiculed for that and told that he doesn't even understand the law either by the Pharisees. So that was kind of interesting. The adulterous woman account. I'll just read that one real quick. Then they all went home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people were gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law of Moses, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman, still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." And that's an illustration of what, Wade had just pointed out a minute ago about you do have to mention the sin, right, when you're forgiving. Jesus is willing to forgive, but he said, told the woman, go and sin no more. (Clears throat) So what was Jesus trying to get what were the Pharisees trying to get Jesus to do? What was the conflict that they were presenting before him? It's on the slide. They were trying to get Jesus to either speak against the law and said, no, you're not required to do that, even though it's what the law says, or speak against the Roman authorities. Either case, Jesus would be on the wrong side there if he did either one of those things. So do we know what Jesus was writing in the dirt to cause the people to leave?
Might have been Deuteronomy 22:20. As I mentioned, I don't know if there was anything that he was writing in the dirt or not at all.
Right.
So then we stand back up. There are no more witnesses. So there's no legal right to stone her.
Right.
Because there are no witnesses there to condemn her.
Good point. What was Deuteronomy 22, Bill? Sorry.
If a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman, and so he shall turn to evil. Israel. And only brought woman to one.
Right. Yep.
She may not have been. Since he said it's in the Lord,
yes, yeah. I've always assumed they were telling the truth. Right. Yeah, we don't know what Jesus was actually writing in the dirt. There's a lot of speculation about it. It's kind of fun to think about, but maybe he was just writing down sins that they had committed, the people standing around, and they recognized themselves and kind of, okay, never mind, walked away. But we don't know for sure. And I said it would pit him against the Roman authorities if he said, yeah, go ahead and stone them, because they weren't allowed to carry out capital punishment under Roman law. In case that wasn't clear. Okay. Okay, November 5th. Basically, a lot of the reading was talking about Jesus proclaiming himself. So this will be out of John. It tells us all about probably the best book for figuring out what did Jesus say about himself and who was he exactly. By the way, there is an issue of Time magazine out right now that just says Jesus in big letters on the cover. I saw it in CVS the other day. It says Jesus, who was he and who is he? Had a lot of pretty pictures in it, but I think Book of John probably does a better job of whatever's in here. But that's out there. It is nice to see, and I like the subtitle. Who was he and who is he?
Right.
Now I don't know how it elaborated on that once inside the cover, but it gave me reason to be positive about maybe what it said. But again, I think we're probably better off just going with what John says about him. And the other apostles. Let's see here. Okay, one of the things some of his listeners said to him was, "Hey, you're saying a lot of stuff about yourself. You're basically saying you're God, is that you are God Himself, or you're God's Son, which makes you divine." And but you're just saying it about yourself. And you know, where's your second witness? And Jesus' response to him was, "Well, you know, I don't actually need a second witness. I can witness for myself." But he said, "But the Father is also my witness, and he and I are one." He says, "If you knew me, you would know my Father also." He says, "You are below, but I am from above. You are of this world, and I'm not of this world. If you don't believe that I am He, you will indeed die in your sins." And most of your Bibles will say, not this one, the word He, I am He, you know, the He is italicized in a lot of Bibles, saying this word isn't really in there in the Greek anywhere. We just added it for your understanding, but it could detract from the understanding, because if it ends with if you don't believe that I am, you know, we know that's was God the Father's, or at the burning bush, you know, that was how God told Moses, "This is I am, you know, who I am." That was his name. So it's kind of more powerful almost without that little italicized word. But if you don't believe that I am He, then you're going to die in your sins. If God were your Father, you would love me, for I have come from God. And then a really interesting statement that he made to them was, "Before Abraham was born, I am." Which really, you know, caused them to want to pick up stones and kill him. Because that really spoke to, you know, I'm not just a guy who showed up, you know, 30 years ago, was born 30 years ago on this earth. I've been in existence before Abraham. And in fact, you know, in eternity. Right. Yeah, you're right. That's interesting. A lot of this what we're going over today is he's not saying a lot of things for the first time that haven't been said before over and over and over again. That's how people learn, right? That's good. We do the same thing here, right? We teach the same stuff over and over and over again. Because we need that. We need the reinforcement. We learn it. We forget it. Oh, yeah, we need to be reminded. So this isn't us condemning these people back there because they're idiots. I mean, they're people like us. We have the same challenges. And I believe that's one reason we do the Lord's Supper every week. That was a blessing from God to have us do that, because we need that reminder every time. Over and over again, just to remember what's most important. Get back on track here with where I'm at. So one of my questions was, what accusations does Jesus make toward the unbelieving Jews, and what points does he keep making about himself? He says that they're basically slaves of sin. Slaves aren't ever permanent members of a household, right? But the Son is, and you're going to continue to be slaves to sin unless the Son, who is sinless, is going to sets you free. And then you'll be free indeed. Trying to make it clear to them that they must rely on him to set them free from sin. And he's pretty blunt in his accusations. You know, says, "You guys, you say you're descendants of Abraham, and you are, but your father's not Abraham. It's the devil." And the reason that you don't believe me and what I'm telling you is because you actually don't belong to God right now. So it's pretty harsh accusations, undoubtedly designed to get their attention and help them see their need for Him. And one of the things that he says is to them is, if you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. And that was kind of one of my questions was, does anyone want to try to answer that one when he was telling the Pharisees, hey, if you were blind, you could see, but since you say you can see, you're actually blind.
Scott, the same line from birth, who healed, accepted who Jesus was in himself, did, obviously, he knew he was blind and hard to see.
Right.
To me, that statement is similar to
right.
If you like that blind man, you would just accept Jesus and what he revealed himself to be. You think you see it.
Right.
So you're not accepting Jesus.
Yeah. It's funny.
Just accepting that he revealed himself to be. And that's one of the lessons that John knows. He's revealed himself. He hasn't hidden himself.
Right. Right. And in the case of... Absolutely. In the case of this blind man, I mean, you know, the Pharisees they questioned him. They questioned his parents to confirm, has he been blind since birth? Because they doubted it. And then they questioned the blind man again about what had happened to them. And they just didn't want to believe that he had been blind and that now he saw. And the blind man got pretty exasperated with the questioning, and you know, And he asked them, well, are you questioning me because you want to become his disciples? It's pretty good comeback, I thought. And then he points out that if Jesus wasn't from God, then he couldn't have done what he did to me. And what was the Pharisees' response? How dare you lecture us, right? That was their response. And that's when Jesus came in and said what he did. Basically saying, okay, since you just refuse to believe, you who think you see now clearly are actually the ones who are blind because you're not allowing your hearts to understand the truth. Okay, found this picture. I'm not going to read the account of, you know, that Jesus describes the sheep in the pen or the fold. But one of the questions I asked was you know, each person or thing in what he said, what are they? So he talked about the good shepherd. He talked about the gate or the door. He talked about, which you can see there. He talked about the gatekeeper, who I guess is the guy sitting there at the gate. He talked about the sheep inside, and he talked about the pasture lands around him. And he also talked about thieves and who would come in. So who is the? I won't hit it. Who are the sheep? Who are the sheep that are in this pen? Who? Old Testament times.
I think it's interesting here as I just read it. We're talking about all the sheep that are in that pen. You've got a mixture of sheep, isn't
it? Yes.
And in that pen, the way I read it, so I'll kind of phrase it that way, you've got the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming in and calling them as the shepherd. The Jews that hear his voice will respond to it.
Yes.
But then later on, I'll get a little ahead of us.
Yeah.
He talks about this other pen that he had out there. That's the Gentiles. Same thing, the mixture. Those that know his voice will hear it and come out as well.
Yep. That's exactly right. Thanks. Yeah, if you didn't hear that in the back, that's an important point. The sheep are a mixture, basically the Jews. Some are going to hear his voice when he calls them. Some are not. And then, as Tony said, he says there are other sheep not of this pen, not of this fold, that are out beyond these walls here. So the wall is what is written here doesn't really say what the wall is, but it does seem to me that you could say it was sin. You could say it was the Old Testament law of Moses that was basically keeping these sheep from being free. And he's coming in and as the door and as the good shepherd, calling to them and leading the ones who want to follow him out. And the others will remain kind of in that space of sin. Remember, the law was given to expose sin. The law was a word, not harsh to us or hostile to us. Yeah. And of course, the pastors out there represent the freedom that Christ offers from all that. So I think we're probably out of time. Do I have time to keep going? Bell ringer? Okay, 2 minutes. All right. Thank you. Let's see, what do we want to cover with a 2 minutes? Well, let's follow up with another question, kind of that. So how does one become one of Jesus' sheep? And this is John 10, 22 through 39 in that area. How did one become Jesus' sheep? Well, the way it's described is Jesus' sheep are those who listen to him and follow him, right? So how do you become one? By listening and following him, being willing to do both of those things. So a little bit of a circular thing, right? But I think that's appropriate. It is up to the hearer to decide whether he's going to continue hearing or interested in hearing, and whether he's going to then do and act on what he's hearing. It's up to the follower. Okay. So once again, I did not get through everything. I apologize for that again. I'll re-gauge the next session to try and make sure I do a little better there. But thank you for your comments and participation.